Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a self-medicating conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Self-medication is a common term used to describe drug use. I don't like it. So let's talk about not using the word self-medication. As a doctor, the word self-medication is an insult to real medications that follow strict standards. We're all aware that in today's world, using politically correct language is big. Control the language, control the narrative. For drugs, the PC language is meant to prevent stigma against the person who uses drugs. That's important. We're human beings. We no longer refer to someone as an addict or junkie. Instead, we use a person with a substance use disorder. I believe we also need to change our language, not just to eliminate stigma on human beings, but also to promote drug prevention. Using the word self-medicate gives legitimacy for using drugs. It says, I had pain, emotional, physical, and therefore I self-medicated with heroin, fentanyl, cocaine, or alcohol. It gives an excuse for using drugs. I had such a hard life. I needed drugs. Anyone else would do it too. According to Oxford Dictionary, the word medication is a substance used for medical treatment. It's for health. The definition does not apply to illicit drugs or non-prescribed drugs. You can drown your sorrows with alcohol, but it's not considered a medication. Self-medicating of illicit drugs makes it sound like we're using an over-counter medication. I had a headache, so I self-medicated with Tylenol or Motrin. But illicit methamphetamine is not the same category as over-the-counter medications that are highly regulated. The US FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is charged with making sure drugs are safe and effective to improve the health of the people of the United States. The FDA does not regulate or recommend illicit drugs or drugs taken outside of a prescription. That's because they're not safe that way and do not promote health. Suggesting that illicit drugs are a medicine or are justified because of physical or emotional ailments jeopardizes the integrity of legitimate medications. Physicians and healthcare workers are held to very strict standards when recommending or prescribing medications. I suggest that we remove the words self-medicate from our vocabulary when it comes to drugs. Tell it like it is. That person had too much alcohol or they had a lot of depression. Don't legitimize an unhealthy habit. The alcohol was not medically indicated. There are other ways and better alternatives to treating pain emotionally or physically. And it's not healthy. Alcohol and other illicit drugs are not a medicine. Get rid of the language self-medicate to promote drug prevention and to maintain the integrity of the word medicine. To learn more about someone who became addicted to drugs and suffered severe emotional pain, I reached out to Matthew Massera. Matthew Massera survived many acts of brutality as a child and spent 27 years with active addiction, criminality, violence, and other drug world activity. He was wounded 14 times by knives and twice by gunshots. Today, he's a man in recovery and attributes his salvation to God. He helps others through Be Bold Street Ministries. Matt was recently featured in a Fox News story titled Crisis in the Northwest, inside one of Oregon's homeless camps with a former drug dealer. I saw that story and had to reach out. To learn more about Matthew Massera and Be Bold Ministries, check out the High Truth show notes. Matthew Massera, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Lev.
I'm really excited for our conversation. I saw your quotes and article in the Fox News story about the homeless in Oregon, and I thought, I got to reach out to this guy. And I didn't even know that you had such a wonderful beard.
Thank you. I'm glad that you did reach out.
And you're talking to us from your office, you say?
Yeah, this is part of the office. So anywhere that there's landmass inhabited by people is my office. So I gotta be with the people. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're now in a, is it a car, minivan?
It's a truck.
It's a truck.
Yeah, downtown Salem, Oregon right now.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's great. Well, you look good. You sound good. I thought we'd start the conversation by sharing with our audience about your life. I read about you. You have like horrible adversities. You describe a life of crime and sadness. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so life did start off really difficult. So my dad was a leader within, the Latin Kings. He did, multiple decades in prison. And so my childhood is not something that I ever want to revisit. Me and my brother were tortured as children, surviving, an assault at 3 years old. Makes no sense. We physically survived based off from the nature of the assault. And that's just one moment. And my dad introduced us to the drug world really early because he was a drug trafficker, heroin user. And so he would have me and my brother tie him off and he'd do a shot of heroin and nod out. And the food for me and my brother on those days was out of the 25-pound bag of dog food. And I look back and I am so thankful that that dog food was there because it ultimately provided me and my brother sustenance while my dad was incapable of caring for us. And so I'm so grateful for it, the hindsight looking back on it. And introduced us to, alcohol, 8 years old, started using crank at 11 years old. And I got stabbed for the first time at 11 years old, was stabbed in the leg and pulled the knife out. And the kid that stabbed me.
What happened? 11 years old.
Yeah. So because my dad's gang activity and involvement, we just acclimated to it. He encouraged us into it. And started to get involved in gang activity, drug activity, criminality, before we were even teenagers. So
telling me that Macera is a Puerto Rican name, is your dad?
Yeah. Yeah, yo soy Puerto Riqueño.
So yeah. Where was all this? Was this in Puerto Rico in the United States?
So this was in Salem. My dad, my pops was born in Puerto Rico, Manati. And then my family came to New York City. So my dad was involved in criminality and gang life there, did time all over New York. And then my grandpa tried to help him get out of it and bring him to Oregon in the, early part of the late 70s.
And what about your mom?
Yeah, my mom's still here. I mean, it's so interesting because she's got multiple master's degrees, worked for the state of Oregon, but was with somebody like my dad for a reason. And they met over a 12-pack of beer, literally. And my dad seen her walking in and said, "You're not going to drink that all by yourself." And then 9 months later, me and my brother were born. And so that's the beginnings.
Yeah. So, but you were raised by your dad, not your mom?
So my mom and my dad, and then we were in the system. So we had foster care family that took us in. Some folks that started watching us at about 4 months old, but when my dad wasn't in prison, he was around and it was always toxic. So me and my brother's lives were on the line. Pistols pointed at us at 5 years old. He murdered somebody in front of me and my brother before we were 10 years old. And while he strangled the life out of that man, he stared me and my brother in the face.
I just can't imagine. I don't know how you could talk about,
there's so much because there's so much to it. And I get to share all around the globe in some of the most dangerous institutions. And people are like, "Your life was really messed up." But I never perceived it that way because that chaos and all that madness and violence and torture started so young. I just thought that was the way it was, that everybody's life was like that. And then I found out that it wasn't the case for everybody else.
Well, when did you figure out that your life was not the norm?
When we my mom finally, she ended up dropping my brother off first. And then about 3 weeks later, gave me up. and said she was going to come back a couple years later. And we got placed with some folks.
How old were you?
We were little. Yeah, we were just a handful of years. Okay. And so much under 10 years old took place. She was staying at a home with some organized crime folks, a part of the 1% community, and we were being brutalized. And so...
What do you mean by the 1% community?
Outlaw bikers.
Outlaw bikers?
Yeah, my mom was staying at a place in Monmouth, Oregon with outlaw bikers, and they were trafficking drugs through the home, and they were harming me and my brother sexually. But that wasn't enough for, you know, the move to take place. It was when the large amounts of drugs started to come through that really changed things. So, and then she finally gave us up and then came back like 2.5 years later, said she was going to be gone a couple weeks. And it ended up being multiple years before she came back to get us. But it was a blessing because those folks really loved us, cared for us, protected us, watched over us, provided for us.
Wow. And tell me about your brother. Your brother was a twin brother.
Yeah, identical twin brother, 1 minute apart. And so, you know, same egg split in two, part of me. And I mean, we even had the same birthmarks, same mole in the exact same location. I mean, it's so close that, you know, people were like, there's no way. And I said, well, I mean, you know, he passed 20 years ago, June 1st. That was one of those fulcrum moments for me, but it wasn't enough for me to stop. But he got saved. God rescued him in high school through his son, Jesus. And I watched him change, and he kept sharing with me. I'm like, that's not for me, man. Like, you know, that's not for me. That's for somebody else. And I just remember watching.
What do you mean? What did he?
So he believed, he believed on the gospel of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of his sins. And I watched him change. God transformed his heart. And I'm like, this is amazing, but I'm still in the midst of just really terrible decisions and organized crime, you know, drug trafficking and violence. And then he went back to the drug world and ended up getting chemical psychosis. And June 1st, 2004, put a sawed-off 22 to the side of his head and pulled the trigger. And part of me died that day. And I'll never forget it, you know, because I was in the midst of the cigar world, professional tobacconist, importing from, you know, Dominican Republic, hand-rolled premium cigars, hand-carved briar pipes. And I just remember the last conversation. And I just lived a selfish life. So he called, and I don't want to hear it anymore from him. And so I started to act like... the phone was breaking up and it wasn't. And he's like, if you can hear me, I love you. And I said, I love you too, if you can hear me. And I meant it when I told him I loved him, but I also wanted to I don't want to hear it anymore. And then, I don't know, it was about 30 minutes later, I felt him die. And I started to throw up before I got the call. And the person I was with had to answer the phone because I was so terribly sick. And then this guy answered the phone and he's like, how'd you know? I said, I felt it. And he started to cry. We came back to the Salem hospital and went and seen my brother in the ER. It was one of those moments. And that was, it's so sad that that wasn't enough for me to stop. And so just went through the 20 year anniversary. And it's just one of those moments, like, you don't, literally part of me died that day. Not figuratively, literally.
Literally. It's your twin, yeah. Part of you.
Yeah. And so it was one of those moments that God did use to, like, you know, set, you know, change course a little bit, but it wasn't enough for me to stop, which I share with people how sad that is.
That was your rock bottom or not yet?
Not yet, which is the sad portion. So I've been... So not long after that, I'm in the midst of the planning and torture and murder of another human being. I hear this man talk about how he wants to violate my son sexually on the phone. My foster brother came to me and said, hey, this guy said he wants to do this to your son. And they said, I don't believe you. Like, you might just have some beef with this guy and you want me to go resolve it, get him on the phone and engage in conversation with him and let me listen. And this guy starts to lay out and I'm going, and I told him to hang the phone up. And I said, so here's what's going to happen. Your friend's going to go. He doesn't get the opportunity. I'm okay with going to prison forever. And he doesn't get to hurt my son like that. And if you tell him, then I'm going to do a thousandfold to you what he's getting. And so in the midst of the planning and preparations for that, I'm walking across the street in South Salem and do a dry run. And in my mind, I said, this is it, God. There's no planning that goes into this where I get away with it. And I used the cerebral capacity that he gave me for his glory. I used it to be successful at being really evil and wicked and a man of malice. And not the moment after that thought was finished in my mind, somebody started yelling my name from across the street. And it was this fella that I had met, like, you know, 10 years before at a youth group. And I didn't know who it was. And then a couple days later, he showed up at my house. And he had continued to share the gospel with me for years. I kept rejecting. And he shared with me again. And then he said, hey, didn't you hear me calling your name the other night? And I said, are you serious? You have no idea the thought that took place in my mind right before you started calling my name. So God revealed to me there was no such thing as coincidence, happenstance, chance, or luck. And he shared with me again the gospel of Christ. And I believed that he paid a price for my sins that I could have never paid, which brings me to this conversation today with a transformed heart as a new man, a new creation. And I get to reach the world in a different way than I used to.
That's pretty incredible. You had, I don't know, like the worst traumatic childhood I could ever imagine. We talked about ACE scores, adverse childhood events. You had an ACE score of like a million, I think.
Yeah, off the charts. Off the charts.
And you're able to really, I'm amazed by how open you are with such, you know, horrible events, and even of you, how open you are of the things that you've been embarrassed about doing. Is there things that you regret that you've been able to completely, you know, forgive yourself for?
That is a great question, because I do talk about that. I was talking about it this week. I have so many regrets. I don't walk in the shame and the guilt of any of them. I asked God to forgive me. He forgave me, and I've been blessed to be able to ask others to forgive me. I acquired 14 knife wounds, a couple gunshot wounds in the drug world, and I did way more of that to other people than they ever thought about doing to me. On top of me exposing my children to the drug world and different acts of violence, and I know that I've been forgiven for everything I ever did. I don't ever doubt it. I don't question it anymore. I did for a period of time. Wow, can I really be forgiven for that? And God's word is really clear. The price his son paid was a propitiation, full payment. And and all my kiddos, they forgave me. And but yeah, there's so many regrets. Because if I say I don't have any, how harmful would that be? Yeah. And I actually do have them, you know, because before I had no conscience prior to believing on the gospel for salvation. And then all of a sudden I start to feel bad about things that I'm doing. I feel guilt. And I am so thankful for that godly sorrow that produces repentance.
That's amazing. Tell me about your family, your mom and dad. How did they turn their lives around too?
Yeah, so my dad, he's been gone for about 7 years, and I was going to murder my dad, and because of a situation that had happened in the drug world, and we disconnected for a bit after that. He jumped out of the car while we were going down 25th Street, 25th and State Street here in Salem, Oregon, jumped out while I was driving, and we disconnected for a few years. God got a hold of my heart. And then I was able to care for him as he passed from lung cancer. And he did believe on the gospel of Christ for the forgiveness of his sins a couple years before he died. And this guy that he murdered a bunch of people, he's a part of what he would do in New York City is he would hotshot people and watch them die and stay long enough for them to not be able to be resuscitated. And that was part of his gig. And he's like laying it all out. He's like, Matthew, I have to get this out. And he's like, I see all their faces. And they haunt me. And he was discipling the nurses that were caring for him in the care home. And not because he told me that, they did after he was no longer capable of speaking. So they'd say he'd come in, he'd be reading his Bible, he'd send them home, and then come back and walk through the verses with him. So he's been gone for 7 years, and my mom still alive, and she's walking out a different life because I used drugs with both my parents, methamphetamine and I just all types of other terrible things within the drug world, and violence, and but they both came to me. And I can't thank God enough for this. And they said, I'm so sorry, Matthew, for everything. And there was no but. Please forgive. And it was followed by, please forgive me. So there's so much thankfulness for that.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, it's true. You want to forgive others because you want to be forgiven for your own. Mm-hmm.
Because I know how much I've been forgiven of.
Yeah. And how about your kids? How many kids do you have?
Between me and my wife, we have 7.
Wow. How old are they?
So we got 13, we got 14, we got 17, we got 20, we got 23, we got 24, we got 28.
Wow. And how are they with relation to drugs?
Yeah, so they are not following the same path that I did, but I'm so thankful for it. I mean, they all have stuff, because everybody does. If somebody says they don't have stuff, that's called lying. So, but they're works in progress, just like I am. And we get to see most of my kids on a semi-regular basis, and we still have a few at home. So that's on a regular basis. Still have 3 kiddos at home. So
that's amazing. So, yeah. And then I the introduction for this episode, I talked about, I don't like the word self-medicate because it legitimizes drug use. And like your child, I can't imagine the drugs, the violence, the atrocities that you didn't just see one time, but sustainably throughout your young life, your young mind. Do you think that that's that makes it that you were using drugs and had an addiction? Is that inevitable?
I don't believe that. Ultimately, my dad introduced me to it. I don't believe that based off from what took place with me as a child set me up for meth addiction or opiate addiction or addictions to violence or gang life or criminality. I was exposed to it. Because my mom and dad were, I don't believe that then invoked a predisposition for me, because I wasn't born a meth addict. I wasn't born an opiate user. I wasn't born violent. I did ultimately acclimate to that world and all those things, because I had choices, and I chose to willingly go use drugs. I chose to manufacture drugs. I wasn't a robot. I never used those deadly substances by accident, and it was never forced upon me. And I always had a willful decision and I chose to do it.
Really? So, even as a child, I can't imagine. Well, your dad gave you drugs and you were 8 years old, but you still feel like you had a...
Give me alcohol. Yeah. I mean, he introduced me to it. But when I started using crank, that was me. Yeah. I pursued it. I went after it. And as soon as I did that first line of crank, I was like, yep, this is what I've been looking for. You know, so I'm trying to fill some need that just wasn't there, because I just had this emptiness, because I'd been brutalized and tortured so much as a child. For sure, I want to be cloudy. So I'm going to make the willful decision to be cloudy. It wasn't like, I don't like this. No, I did. I liked it. You know, and there's a bunch of results to it that weren't my favorite. But was I willing to go through that for the high? And I was. I proved it out for multiple decades.
That's interesting. So I noticed that people who've had real serious substance use disorder and are now living in nice recovery, like you're so blessed to be, don't mind calling themselves addicts, even though the rest of us are told not to use that terrible language to stigmatize people.
Yeah. So that's a great, I'm glad you brought that up. So for me, I no longer identify myself as an addict. You know, I've got over 9 years of victory, because for me within Christ, if I say that I've been forgiven for all my sins, because what I had was a sin problem. If I say I've been forgiven for all my sins, and that was enough to forgive me of my sins and all the unrighteousness that led up to all of it, but not enough to take the identity, that's to say the price he paid was not sufficient. And so my identity today is I'm a child of God, citizen of heaven, heir to the King, one who has overwhelmingly conquered. I'm an ambassador. And what I love about that term ambassador, it's never about the ambassador. By definition, it's always about the one who sent me, you know, and so it's always about him.
You have a very calm, mellow persona. Were you always that way, even in the height of methamphetamine and violence?
Great question. So in the midst of the violence, there could be a calm, controlled demeanor in the violence, but the man that you see and hear today was produced by the God of all creation through his son, Jesus Christ. He really transformed my heart, and I needed a new way of thinking, and I begged him to do it. Cause my mind to function the way you intended it to.
Wow. So you know, the article on Fox News described you as a drug dealer with the homeless, somebody who has that experience. Tell us what it was like to be homeless in Oregon.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, in Oregon, it was terrible the whole time. I can say right off the bat, if anybody tells you that they like being homeless, they're not doing well. I can speak for everybody, because who wants to not bathe for a few months? Who wants to eat rotten food? Who wants to have people constantly trying to attack them? Because when you're on the streets, the mind is constantly, you know, releasing cortisol, because you're in a constant state of fight or flight. And for me, there was no flight. It was always fight. Like I'm going into this head on, and there's constant physical maladies and infirmities and all kinds of, I was drinking river water, you know, creek water. I'm eating literally rotten food, and then, you know, in and out of hospitals, you know, being treated for everything that comes with that. And I remember falling, hitting my head on a rock, and I'm in the river, and I'm so thirsty, I just start to drink it.
Oh.
My head's bleeding, and I just need some water. And there was many times where I'd go 3 months without a shower.
That's hard.
Yes.
You talked about what people yelled out at you as somebody who's homeless. Can you...
Yeah, I'm literally within, you know, 100 feet from where this one man looked me right in the face and said, "Hey, low life, nobody loves you. Why don't you kill yourself?"
What did you think when he said that?
Oh my gosh, I was I my only response was I just put my head down in shame and started to bawl. I started to cry so hard that no sound was coming out. You know, but the tears were just pouring out of my tear ducts. You know, it was a terrible moment.
Ugh.
And that's just one of many, you know, unpleasantries that was shared with me vocally by people that had it all figured out, right?
So I'm an emergency physician, and I've in downtown San Diego treat a lot of people who are homeless. What was your experience in the emergency departments?
Oh, that's a great question. I was treated terribly.
I'm sorry.
And it was like, and I know that there's been a little bit of a transition here because I get to sit in different meetings and in different committees and in, you know, in different rooms at different tables to be able to share those experiences with the hope of a transition, right? Because, you know, there's a lot that leads somebody up to being homeless. And nobody in kindergarten, when their teacher says, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? Nobody said that's where they want to be. Zero people. And there's a story behind every person that's on the street. So to disregard every moment leading up to it is really to disregard, depreciate, denigrate the individual in their entirety.
I do talk to people, Matthew, who, like I'm thinking of this one young girl, she had a home. I forget where it was, Kansas or something. She said she had a home. And I asked her, but you left your home to be homeless in San Diego? And she goes, yes, I'd rather be homeless in San Diego than in her home in her situation where she actually had a house. So, and you must see this too, where we offer shelter to people and people choose, they'd rather be on the street in a tent and have independence and not have to follow the rules that a shelter has. And they prefer that to being homeless. What do you think of that?
Yeah, so, I mean, that can happen. There are people like here, specifically in Oregon, because we've got a bunch of spotlights on us nationally, and they're negative spotlights in reference to, you know, access to treatment and mental health. And, you know, there are many people on the streets, and due to criminal convictions, it is almost impossible for some of these folks to get housed. And so how does somebody deal with that, right? And then there are people that leave their home because the streets are safer than home, which should be really insightful for people. Because that, you know, as a kid, my first experience with homelessness was before I was a teenager, and it was safer on the streets than it was at home. And then people will escape DV situations. There's so many stories. There's not a one size fits all for the narrative, somebody that's on the street. And there are other people, they're just like this nomadic life going from city to city. There's people that I've run into that we get to minister to in different cities, you know, in different parts of the nation, because they're just cruising from city to city.
Did you realize, and the people who talk to realize, that they have a high risk of death? I mean, we know as an emergency physician that somebody who's homeless has a much higher chance of dying from whatever than someone who has a home.
Yeah, and people are aware of that. There are a lot of people that are passing all the time, and the city and society doesn't skip a beat. I've been able to do multiple celebration of life services, and multiple for people that, you know, have overdosed and not survived the overdose, especially here in Oregon with some of the policies that are recently have been changed. But for multiple years now, overdose deaths have gone up.
Yeah.
And that's within the house community too, not just people on the street.
Right. No, fentanyl is just killing Americans. I think it's an attack on our country, but it's especially hitting the homeless hard. How did you change? You describe that you changed through God, through being forgiven, through wanting to be a good person. But physically, how did you do that? Were you withdrawing? How did you go from homeless to to having shelter, to you know, to having, you know, the nice life that you have now? How did it physically happen to you?
Oh, it was a process. It was God rescued me, and I'm still involved in all of the criminality, but the process of sanctification started, and I'm so thankful for it. But it was, you know, I was on the streets for about a decade. And so this last September, 9 years ago, I went to pick up some methamphetamine from somebody I'd used with before. And to the middle of the night, I get back to this apartment that I was able to stay in. And I put the, what I thought was dope, right, in the can, and I'm going to shoot it up. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, it's really obvious it's not meth. And I'm going, wow. And I just looked in the mirror, and the book of James came back to memory. You know, the natural man looks at his face in the mirror, but as soon as he's walked away, he forgets what he's seen. But the opposite took place. And I just talked to myself, I don't think this is what God's intended for you. I know it's not. I know it's not. And then I called this fella, his name's Matt McCollin. He's a pastor now. And I said, I don't even know what this looks like, but I'm going to be at group on Monday. And it's this group called The Most Excellent Way. It's a Christ-centered addictions victory group. And brings me to this conversation today. But my mind was still not right because of all the substances. I was shooting up methamphetamine every couple of hours for many years at that point. And I'm smoking it. And so I this last April 5th, it was 9 years, and I overdosed on that day. And as soon as the dope hit my heart.
On fentanyl?
On methamphetamine. And I did get methamphetamine that was laced with fentanyl, but I started using fentanyl with Duragesic patches years ago. And I had a clinician that I was going to, an FNPC, that I would trade hand-rolled premium cigars to and liquor for, you know. So for he would come in, and this is the conversation. Are you here for your candy? And then he'd write me prescriptions and of multiple narcotics, and then he would give me samples from different people that would come in, different reps, like ProVigil. So I'd go in, I'd give him cigars and booze, and I'd leave with brown paper bags full of different sampled medications and prescriptions.
Did that guy go to jail?
Yeah, so he's no longer practicing from, you know, my understanding, but I would, you know, I did that. The opiate portion of my addiction was about 11 years.
Yeah. Most doctors are good. So to hear the bad ones go to jail or stop practicing, I think is important.
I agree, because I was taking in so many narcotics that it doesn't make any, it's a miracle that we're having this conversation. And by definition is a miracle that something that would never happen, right?
Yeah.
After the amount of stuff that I put into my body is amazing. To have any type of cerebral functions.
So you said it was a process. It took some time. You knew where to go to get help, even in the midst of addiction. And you really nicely describe that it takes a while to get your brain back from drugs. You don't just, you know, stop one day and get it off. How long did it take you to get your brain back?
So, I mean, the first, it was, I don't know, it was probably a good year and a half before, but all day long, my go-to, you know, my thinking was off, because violence was the response to every situation. How do you solve it? Well, be violent. Just shut down the scenario. And so I was begging God, please let this heart and mind be in me, which was first in your son. Amen. God help me. Amen. And then I've got people around me, right? Wise counselors that I'm talking to and I'm sharing. They're like, well, what's going on? And I said, well, this situation happened and I just want to just pummel this person into the ground. And that's that was my drug world mentality. So it just was, it was rough. So it was a while. It was a while.
I when I see people who are in the midst of drugs and they want to, I tell them to give themselves at least 6 months or a year before they get their drug, their brain back to thinking. But you were able to reprogram your brain, not just from addiction, but also for your anger. You're able to turn anger around. That a lot of people can't do that, even without the life of imprinted violence from childhood. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, because I believe that my addiction to violence was even more significant than the substances. I thrived on the power, and it was terrible.
You changed a lot. You said even like your demeanor changed, your attitude changed. What about your philosophy of drugs? How did that change?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I used to be all for it. And I am adamantly opposed. My position is diametrically different. It's the antithesis of what it used to be. So it's 180 degrees from where it was before. And so, which motivates so much of what I get to do on a daily basis, you know, going and sharing with people, you know, active cartel members and syndicates in different parts of the world and around the nation and on the streets daily, you know.
You have credibility because you've lived the other side.
Yeah, the experiential knowledge is super helpful because the ability to relate is there. And I don't purchase blue sky from anybody because it's always there, even if it's cloudy. So nobody's going to be able to like try to manipulate me with manipuspeak or trick knowledge. I'm like, hey, no, I'm willing to walk through this with you. I'm not going to tell you that it's going to be easy, but like, let's walk this out together.
What about your attitude towards law enforcement? I'm sure at one point in your life, they're not your favorite people.
I don't want to have a ton of contact with them. Yeah, but now we actually have memorandums of understanding with like the Salem Police Department, Marion County Sheriffs. We get to share with law enforcement on a regular basis, you know, in trainings. And then we work together, you know, like so they literally call and ask us to come help. You know, in certain situations, I was just sitting with a fella, got a call from an officer, and he was in the midst of being super intoxicated. And now he's headed into 2 years clean and sober. And it all started with a police officer that called me and said, hey, can you come help? And so that happens on a regular basis.
Isn't that beautiful? There's actually a beautiful partnership between public health and public safety.
Yeah.
Right. We all want a better world and to save people and just, and you need both.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are you a peer counselor also for drugs and addiction?
So I have no, certifications in reference to like CADC, you know, training or, you know, accreditations or anything like that, or even a peer support. You know, I disciple people, you know, from the Word of God. And so that, but I get to walk it out, you know, do I have the role of a peer? Yeah. As a minister. So I'll go, it's all about the Word and then help people get connected to detox and, you know, different treatment opportunities and options, those that they're willing to walk through. And then there's some that I don't. Because of the nature of those options, right?
Right. So what really struck me when I read the article on Fox about you is that you're a critic of the homeless and drug policies. Like, okay, so tell us, what are we doing wrong, Matthew?
Oh, wow. So here in Oregon, there was a measure called Measure 110. And Measure 110 made a few promises, right? Decreased crime, increased public safety, lives saved. Well, one of the components of Measure 10 was the decriminalization of deadly mind-altering substances like methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, certain amounts of those substances, right? Fentanyl. And people can use, there can be open-air drug use. There is nobody that was ever a part of the drug world that would ever say that by decriminalizing any amount of those substances, that you're going to save more lives, that public safety would be increased and crime would go down. That is, I laugh when I just even saying it. It's so right. Ludicrous.
I actually had a podcast here with the head of the Poison Center of Oregon before that passed. And I said, mm-hmm. this is a very dangerous experiment because you could make things a lot worse. And he said, we'll have to watch it. But I think I'm actually proud of Oregon for realizing that they made a mistake.
Yes. And we've spoke out vocally over it for many, 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 well, for the entire time before it started. And since, you know, we're now, it's getting ready to change. So there will be some recourse. You know, when it comes to those substances, and I believe it's coming latter part of this year where that will go into effect.
Yeah. It's not a, what do you think about decriminalizing drugs versus what we're doing, which is normalizing drugs and even promoting drug use?
Yeah. Decriminalizing those substances is always terrible. It's never a good idea. Nothing good will ever come from it.
Should somebody go to jail if they're just holding a bag of meth?
So that's a great question. I would need to ask some clarifying questions of what they're doing with that methamphetamine. I believe that selling those substances should always be a criminal offense. Right. Because everybody I know, and I know tons of people with, you know, combined, we're talking thousands and thousands of years of active time in drug world criminality, organized crime, cartels, syndicates, and just the drug world. And everybody says, it saved my life when I got arrested. Like, it, nobody that was ever actually a part of the drug world would ever say that anything good was going to come from that. And encouraging those substances is just encouraging somebody to, you know, cure themselves of their physical health, spiritual health, right, good relationships. It cures you of a great many things.
Yeah. My red line is when you're hurting another human being. If you're just holding something and it's just for yourself and it's not associated with another crime, you know, I consider that decriminalization. But once you cross the red line of hurting someone else, selling, stealing, violence, that crosses a red line.
So, and anybody that's ever operated in the drug world, they've been involved in violence, physical violence. That's my only reference point. And I've engaged the drug world all around the world. My only reference point is that everybody that's in the drug world, they have experienced acts of violence, been a part of acts of violence. And me and my wife, we talk about it all the time because she does have, she's a LCSW, CADC2, and, you know, QMHP, tons of credentials after being an acid, you know, manufacturing LSD and all this type of stuff. So we talk about that often. We laugh when, because there's nobody that was a part of the drug world that wasn't at some point in time involved in physical violence.
You're critical of the housing first model because it doesn't have preconditions. Tell us, what do you think about that? Because everybody says, you know, housing first, and then you figure out drugs, addiction, whatever. Why is that bad?
So I refer to it as a out of sight, out of mind program. Because once somebody gets in there, there's no requirement to address the A&D component or the mental health component. You know, that's a part of it. And then, so you get somebody, you know, some sort of supported housing or government assisted housing, and those things continue. The A&D component isn't addressed, right? And so somebody turns their home into a drug den and then they're evicted. Well, based off from the structure that is currently here in Salem, once they get evicted, that individual, with the way it's laid out here currently, they are ineligible for government-assisted housing for 3 years. So they're back on the street.
Yeah.
And not only like, so they're ineligible. So there's so many people that we're reaching out to on a regular basis that was the situation, and they're back on the streets. And so ultimately it's just a false hope component. It's super loving, and compassion goes hand in hand with accountability. Like, no, to get these services, we need you, where you have to engage in A&D treatment. You have to engage in mental health treatment. That's super loving. It just is, oh, just keep doing whatever you want is unloving.
Matthew had one of my favorite homeless patients that came to the ER, like every week, everybody knew his name. Oh, Alex, there you are, Alex Soto. May he rest in peace. He'd come in the emergency department every week in horrible psychosis, and we gave him his shot of antipsychotic medications. He was very much addicted to methamphetamine, and I'm sure that made just his underlying schizophrenia worse. And the county got him housing. He finally got housing. And then in the housing, he died of fentanyl, because there was fentanyl laced in his methamphetamine. I don't feel like we did justice to Alex, because of exactly what you're saying. There should be preconditions. And he may be alive today if we got him, if that was part of it. We failed as a society to take care of a guy who, like, really couldn't take care of himself. And I remember seeing people who also got housing, and in the housing, they're still abusing their drugs and ending up in the ER, and they're not able to care for themselves on their own. They need to get out of that cycle, and then they could benefit from the housing. So I do agree with, like, behavior modification. That's how we get people out, and by rewarding, you know, incrementally behavior that gets you out of the pit. So,
yeah, and how, I mean, in those, you know, the housing first model, how does somebody quantify success? I mean, the data proves here that it's unsuccessful. All the folks know it. So it's just dumping hundreds of millions of dollars into a black hole.
But also, people want a safe environment, right? And if your housing isn't safe, I mean, there may be people in that housing who want to use drugs and thumbs who don't. But if you mix the two, then you're not giving a safe environment to the people who want a safe environment.
I love everything you just shared, because there's people here that have modeled programs like low barrier shelters. And they say it's a safe, loving environment. Where the drug world is allowed to operate, safe and love are not there.
Right, because we see people who they're afraid of their housing.
Yes.
Yeah. And the whole open drug market, right, allowing drug use, I don't think that's compassionate.
It's the opposite of compassionate.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I see it every day. I mean, there is somebody that just off to my right about 15 feet that since we've been in this interview is using substances right in front of a restaurant in downtown Salem.
Yeah. I want to read you something. I just got this text today from a friend. And here's from Maine, the state of Maine's Harm Reduction Coalition. It says, handing out free boofing kits to help fentanyl addicts squirt drugs up their butts. Okay. I mean, this is almost funny, but it's true. This is tax dollars going to teach people how to use drugs
in their rectum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So I disagree with that completely. Just like needle exchanges, I understand the premise behind the needle exchange and that portion of harm reduction. You know, not wanting somebody to get a bloodborne pathogen. I totally get that. And I also know personally that every needle exchange has a body count associated with it, because they give them the tool, the implement based off from bringing in dirty needles. And there are many people that go, they take that tool that they got from, you know, a government entity or a secular nonprofit, and they put the deadly substance into it that ends up being the overdose they don't survive. And there's people that I know personally, they're gone, and that was the narrative.
I think that needle exchange, different than safe injection sites, two different things. But needle exchange has has shown in a public health way of decreasing harm, if that's addition for harm reduction. So you're using drugs. Now you could keep using dental needles, and now I have to treat your HIV and your hepatitis and everything else. So it actually costs society more. But if we give you clean needles, and maybe even you'll connect to treatment, although I know that that would be nice if it was stronger. But we do save, we do save healthcare dollars by decreasing HIV, just like you said, hepatitis and other blood poor passages. Now, that's different than safe injection sites where the data is not there. A lot of people are saying, oh, yes, we want to promote places where people can use drugs, but we can get all into that. But I don't think the data shows that. The data shows that, yeah, people don't die there, but they just die somewhere else. They don't like, right? And they measure, oh, look how many pounds of needles we've saved. And the people are saying that are, you know, New York is shown as a model. Look, we have these places in New York and nobody died in those areas, right? But the total death toll of fentanyl in New York has not gone down. They just don't die in that little spot. They die somewhere else. And I don't know how many people, or they don't even measure how many people got to treatment or recovery from using these sites, because that's not really the goal. And the other thing is I thought of, they said they have 80,000 unsheltered people who don't have homes in New York City, but they go to shelters. They are shelters. So there's 80,000 people living in shelters. And those are essentially safe injection sites, right? They have naloxone. They reverse things. So there are theirs. What I think we need is, you know, places to be safe to get away from drugs. From when you make that decision, I don't want to take that fentanyl that looks funny to me like you had, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go that's safe for you? That's what we don't have. We have lots of places to use drugs. What we don't have, what we should be investing in, is people who make that decision. It's like, okay, I want to get better. I don't know how. I don't know where to go. And you need to get out of that environment where there's drugs all around you. Where is that? Where are we investing in that?
Yeah, because there is tons of places where people can go use drugs.
Right, but there's not a ton of places to get away.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Anything else you think that from your lived experience we should be doing better?
I just, you know, holding people responsible is really loving and compassionate. I'm so thankful for the people that love me enough to have the hard conversations.
Wow.
You know, just encouraging somebody into whatever they want to do. Like, hey, you just do you. Well, for me, a long time, that was me stabbing people, dealing drugs. And I'm like, nobody wanted to, nobody should have encouraged me into continuing that lifestyle. You know, somebody telling me I'm doing great while I'm sticking a needle in my arm or my foot, or like, I don't need people to lie to me, you know, lying, half-truths, manipulations, the omitting of pertinent information, like was only harmful to me. I needed somebody to look me in the face and be honest, you know, and not placate or co-sign my drug use or my gang activity.
How do you do that in a compassionate way?
I get to do it all week long because people know, like, when I'm interacting with them, I genuinely love and care for you. And I said, I'm not able to co-sign any of these behaviors. Like, I'm going to walk through this with you, but you know that you're still involved in gang activity and criminality. I had at the beginning of this week. You're not doing well. You're hurting people for a living, you know, and it doesn't come from a place of anger when I share that. It genuinely comes from a place of love, genuine love and care for the individual and the folks that are being harmed.
Yeah, I love that attitude. And what's the response?
It's always it's always been received well.
Because people could say that you care. People could say that you care.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And because I needed more people to share with me, no. And more often than not, the response is, thank you for telling me the truth. I got more than enough people lying to me.
Wow. You know, It makes me think back about, as a physician, when I started saying no to patients who were there to just to get, like the doctor that you said, their patients were, there was a period where patients come to the ER every day and they just wanted their drugs, and physicians weren't able to say no for multiple reasons. And I was one of the first to kind of resist that. And I say, you know what, I care about you, and I'm not going to do something just because you ask me to. And then they would get mad. Some people would get mad. Some people walk away. But it's like, you know what? I'm not going to do something bad just because you're asking me to. And I wrote an article that's saying it was like being a good doctor is like being a good parent. Sometimes you say no to your children because you love them. Right?
Yes. If we're not saying no to our children, what we've done is stopped parenting.
Yeah.
Like I just shared that yesterday. I was able to share with 2 fifth grade classes. I'm not okay with all of my children's choices and decisions, which is really loving, you know? And the kids thought that was great.
Yeah.
Did I tell my kids no? Because I love them. That will hurt you. I tried it a million times. Please don't. You know, let's have a conversation. You know, let's walk it out together.
So the fact that you care and love when you reach out to somebody who's in the depths of addiction, I think that shows through, and that's why you're accepted. But do they hear you? Do they follow your recommendations? Or does it sometimes yes, sometimes no?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's people that they're no longer here because they continued. Right. And I continue to direct people back to the word because it'll never return void. It'll renew the mind. And so I bring nothing to the table of me. There are many people that they listen, they respond, you know, because I'm out sharing the gospel, making disciples. And then, There are folks that reject and they continue on in the drug world, and I come alongside their family after they pass.
Yeah. I just feel for you, Matthew. You've had a hard life and you still do.
As I tell people, it's like I was, you know, what was never promised to me from Genesis to the end of Revelations or any of us, easy and comfortable. But all the while being immeasurably blessed, because nobody's too far gone for the God of all creation to rescue through his son. I had been written off by many. No hope, lost cause, unreachable, unlovable, you know, worthless. And those were all lies. God never said that about me.
Yeah, no.
Or anybody else.
Right. Absolutely true. That's beautiful. What you give a lot of hope. So Be Bold Ministries. Mm. You created that as a beautiful remedy to help others. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we are a Great Commission ministry. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations while baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching people to observe all that God has commanded us while knowing he's with us to the end of the age. And so I get to do it here, you know, reach out to everybody, God's target population. So folks on the street, people that are in affluent neighborhoods, highways, byways, low income. We got a neighborhood called Felony Flats here. So everybody, you know, God desires for none to perish and all to come to repentance. And I know it's beyond me to not share. I cannot be silent. If just for a moment I could snap my fingers and somebody could know what I know and have in my heart, I cry often, and more often than not, the tears of joy, because I'm under no self-induced illusion of who I was without him. And I proved that apart from him, I can do nothing. And I love that he is an all-inclusive savior. It was never about me showing up with qualifications, adequacies, or worthiness, because if it was, I'm in trouble. But the whole time he's like, Matthew, I love you. I made a way for you to be right with me and is say yes to what my son did for you on your behalf that you could have never done. And I get to share that with everybody all around the world and go in some of the most dangerous people groups that the world has to offer with no fear. Put my life on the line for some really lame stuff before.
Yeah. Wow. And your motto, I love your motto, so dope, from dope dealer to hope dealer.
Yeah. Right?
And yep. Isn't that on your shirt? Are you wearing that on your shirt?
Yes.
See that?
Yep. Yep. Hope dealer. Yeah. The hope that'll never disappoint. Yep. The gospel of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of sins.
So do you get called or you randomly go to these neighborhoods? You get in your truck every day and go to different places?
Yeah. Yeah. All over. I've been different parts of Oregon so far this week, from as far as Bend to Jefferson and Albany and, you know, Salem, the surrounding areas. We'll be in New York City this year, be in Colorado next month.
Wow.
At a national conference and the potential to be in Kenya, going into 4 institutions with over 1,000 adults in custody. And so that's still in the works, but for sure we'll be in New York City in September. Wow. I'm really looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to next month and every day, not missing any of the moments, because I'm here with you this morning sharing as if it's the last time I'll ever be able to, because tomorrow's not promised. And so it just, if I were to pass after our conversation and you were to show up my celebration of life service, what would you say that, you know, we spoke about? And so I really try to be intentional in light of eternity, making the most of every moment. And I'm thankful to God for the moments I get to revisit and conversations I get to revisit.
Wow. We'll get to revisit this one because it'll be on a podcast. But I mean, wow, you're, it's inspiration. I've always noticed people who live in recovery have sage advice, even to people who don't have a substance use disorder. Mm. I think so. But what do you run into people who are not religious, they're atheist, or they're a different religion? I'm Jewish, but I relate to the principles, all the principles that you mentioned. So how do you differentiate, or you're only able to, you know?
Yeah, no. So I get to interact with people from all different walks of life, all different faith traditions, all the time on a regular basis, all over the world, you know, share the gospel. They share with me and, you know, having conversations all the time, you know, people from, you know, been in India. And, you know, that people share with me multiple, like, you know, they get 2 million plus deities, and just being able to share with everybody. And I get to share where I found the hope that will never disappoint, you know, and then and people share with me, you know, where they're, you know, what their walk looks like.
You have experience personally and deal with other with homelessness. What's your advice to me and my colleagues as emergency physician and personnel and staff in dealing with people who are homeless, who come in the emergency department?
They've been unheard for a long time, and they're invisible to most of society, and the portion of society that they're not invisible to, they're hated by because they hear it. It doesn't mean that that's a one for one. Everybody hates every person that's on the streets. But it could be the first time in a really long time anything kind has been shared with them vocally.
A kind word. What about dealing with people? I'm sure you have experience with this, and it sounds like you even had this behavior yourself, who are, their behavior does not, makes it very hard to be kind. They're cursing, they're spitting, they're being violent, they're assaultive. Mm-hmm. And then, so that creates an immediate reaction with, I mean, we're only human. What's your recommendation there?
Yeah, I've, when it comes to somebody that's being assaultive and combative physically, I call law enforcement.
Yeah, sometimes we need to do that.
That's appropriate. You know, and then unfortunately in Oregon, sometimes that's how the person gets the services they need.
I've heard some physicians who are extremely liberal who said that, well, if you're assaulted at work, you have to understand that that person had an addiction and forgive them for that. But to me, again, I said my red line is when you hurt someone else. And if you're, I've been assaulted twice at work. And our staff is regularly assaulted, and I understand that people have a, you know, brain disorder of addiction, but I don't think that that's an excuse to hurt someone else. And there needs to be deterrence, because, like you said, that's compassion, right?
Yeah, healthy boundaries is appropriate. Not only appropriate, it's necessary. No, it's not okay for you to hurt me. You know, no matter what the situation is. So somebody is intoxicated or, you know, whatever they have going on, no, it's not, I'm not treating you like that. It's not okay for you to harm me physically or attempt to harm me physically. And there are results to it, you know, because I've had stuff. I had my left leg peppered with a 9mm round. And this was from a housed community member, right? Doing outreach, sharing the gospel with them, super intoxicated. And right as I get into my vehicle, he looks me right in the eye, chambers around, and pulls the trigger. And he's like, we got to get out of here. And I was like, no, dude, what's going to happen is you are not safe with your wife and children. So I'm going to pull over down the road and I'm calling the police and I'm pressing charges. You're going to jail.
And you did that not because you're vengeful.
No, because I love him and I care for him, want the best for him. And he just looked at somebody who he called a friend while he was intoxicated, chambered around and pulled the trigger. Like, and almost blew the left side of my foot off, peppered the whole side of my left leg. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, are you serious? Yeah, but I also get that. So if there was somebody equipped for the moment, I'm thankful that it was, you know, God had placed me there. And after the no contact order was released, I was able to, because he got arrested, he was taken down. And there were consequences that were appropriate. And then I was able to go back and share the gospel with him. He said yes to the free gift of salvation and asked for forgiveness from God and me. And it was given on both ends. And he is a
dear friend. So you narked on him and he still forgave you because you saved him.
Yeah. The term, the old terms, right? Like snitch, narc, rat, all these things. Life in Christ, that goes out the window. You know, because those are worldly terms and people can battle with it. Coming out of that old life, you just don't ever do that. That's part of the politics of that life, right? You keep your mouth shut. You don't tell on people. You get street revenge, whatever it is. But those types of things will continue to persist if people do not respond that way, right? If I know somebody is committing a bunch of crimes and I don't ever turn them in, then I'm culpable.
I like that attitude. What's your advice to people, not physicians, people on the street, they're walking to see their movie, they're going to a restaurant, and they're, you know, California has even more homeless people than Oregon. We're the number one state in the United States for the unhoused. I think 50% of all homeless, unsheltered people live in Southern California. So the citizens interact with homeless people, and the tendency is to walk away or, you know, not make contact or fear. What do you think should be the right answer? Some people give money, they feel bad, they just give money. What's the right thing to do?
Can I address the money thing?
Yeah.
Do not ever give anybody that is on the streets cash.
Every person who's been homeless, who's now in recovery, says that. Do not give money.
So, because if you don't know what's going on in their life, somebody can get enough fentanyl to kill multiple people for a $5 bill,
yeah.
Right? And so, well, what I hear is the position of my heart is in the right place. So what they do with it is up to them. No, God gives us wisdom. And wisdom says, do not do that, because it could be the time, you know, because I had somebody down in downtown Salem, you know, at a location here that would go and put $5-$10 bills on the easement. I got his pattern down. I went and picked it all up, and then he kept me high for multiple days. Yeah. And it's never without knowing the individual and what's going on in their life. You know, it's
you may be doing more harm than good.
Yeah. Like I, if somebody's hungry and I'm in the midst of that moment with them, for sure, I'm going to feed them. My Savior fed a lot of people. So I'm going to feed somebody, give somebody a drink, you know, water, food, socks, and then being wise in the interactions too. Like I tell people that are unfamiliar with, you know, encampments or communities on the street, don't go. If you want to go in, find, you know, a church, or other folks that are familiar with the community, because it's not safe.
It's not safe. What about just walking on the street? Like, you know, we have it not just, I mean, you sometimes can't avoid walking by encampments on the way to fancy restaurant. They're just everywhere. What do you do?
So I greet people, you know, and no matter what, like, even if I'm not able to stop, cause I can't do everything. I'm not called to that.
Yeah.
Nobody's called to do everything, but I will connect. I will make eye contact and greet the folks that I walk by that are on the streets.
Just say hello.
Yes. It's good to see you. Cause even if they're in the midst of rough situations, I mean it when I tell them it's good to see them and that I hope to see them again and have a conversation. So, but then if I'm able to, let's have the conversation now, you know, so greeting somebody, even if it's, but so many people that, you know, intentionally try to avoid eye contact. And it's not a part of, I remember what that felt like, you know, so being able to greet people as I would anybody else, is the standard.
Yeah. I like the, you have a remarkable history, what you've gone through. It is a miracle how you've been able to turn around. And I agree with you that there's no coincidences. It all comes from God, as you have seen that. And so really, I'm proud of you. I'm happy for you. And I, you know, I'm inspired by how you're able to share this and save many other people as well, physically and spiritually. What is your final words of advice and wisdom that you want to share?
Yeah, he does it. He lets me be a part of it. The results are all his. I get to share, which is amazing to me. And so everybody that sees this message, I genuinely love and care for you. And God produced that, because before I was so selfish. I'm so thankful. So yeah, God bless you all, and thank you for the opportunity. This time has been an unbelievable blessing.
Thank you, Matthew, and may continue to have health and success in the mission of your work and helping others.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.